Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about the DA's alternative to BEE, which was launched yesterday. We're going to be talking about clashes between different police forces in the country, and we're going to be speaking a little bit about ghost employees across government. How many are there? It's a good question. So yesterday, the DA unveiled their alternative policy to black economic empowerment. The DA has been moving away from black economic empowerment for a long time, and they've said that they would pursue alternative policies to it, ones that were not racially based, but rather looked at essentially the impact of various companies on the society around them. So I'm going to just read a little bit from the policy paper here, the document that the DA put out when they announced their policy yesterday. Broad-based black economic empowerment has failed to improve the economic circumstances of South Africa's disadvantaged majority. The unemployment rate for black South Africans was recorded at 35.8% in Q4 of 2024 by Stats SA, against 6.7% amongst white South Africans. From 2014 to 2024, the black employment rate increased by 8.6 percentage points, while the white unemployment rate decreased by 1 percentage. Inequality also remains at a staggering level in South Africa, with a Gini coefficient of 0.63, which is among the highest in the world. According to the Household Affordability Index, approximately 64.2% of black South Africans are found to be living below an upper poverty line of 1,634 rand per month. This equates to just under 30 million people out of a total black population of 51 million. Much discussion on South Africa still centers around racial inequality. However, the fact is that inequality amongst black South Africans is now the greatest in South Africa. The DA's proposed scorecard seeks to direct public procurement away from race-based classifications such as those under triple BEE towards a more inclusive evaluation system utilizing the UN's SDGs, directly addressing the root causes of inequality of opportunity. The DA's model emphasizes value for money while also acknowledging the role that businesses can play in sustainable development and economic growth. This approach fosters a fair, outcomes-oriented framework and offers a non-racial alternative to existing preferential procurement policies. Technical and financial value is carefully balanced against tangible contributions towards addressing the root causes of inequality and opportunity. So then they have a series of tables which break down essentially how this is supposed to work. So they've got three components. There's disqualification criteria. In other words, you know, are you connected to corruption or misrepresentation, in which case you automatically get disqualified. Then 80% of your final score when you bid for a government contract is weighted on how much value for money do you provide. Then 20% is on economic inclusion metrics. Things that you can get economic inclusion points for are feeding schemes, scholarships, mobile healthcare units, local hiring, small business support, women empowerment initiatives, renewable energy projects, recycling, legal aid centers, NGO partnerships, or a combination of those sort of things. When it comes to what they mean by value for money, they've broken it down into a series of criteria, how competitive the price is, the technical capability and quality, reliability and delivery, innovation and technical solutions, delivery and operational capacity, compliance and risk profile. Terence, we'll get to what the response to this has been after we've talked about the policy itself, but this seems pretty good. The Zondo Commission pointed out that value for money is extremely important, and this is the constitutional sort of imperative of our procurement system. And it seems like the DA has really taken that to heart and including this. And also they've found a way to, you know, show that businesses can uplift communities without taking racial criteria into account. This seems like a very positive step forward. What do you think about this?
I think that the most important thing is that a policy like this has been put on the table. I'm not expecting any rush to adoption, but I think that this shows the holy cow is bleeding if not slaughtered. Just a couple of years ago, the leadership of the DA was declaring itself very much in favor of BEE. So this is good. I think that, you know, what they've done is twofold. I think they've responded to what an objective reading of the record of BEE would show. It's very interesting to me that BEE is very seldom defended on its record. It's defended kind of on its intentions, and then in very broad strokes, well, we wouldn't have a black middle class if it wasn't for BEE, which is ridiculous. You know, if the government wants to take credit for that, try employment in the civil service, which is something we'll get to. That's been a far greater driver. The other thing is just that South Africa really can't afford the current BEE model anymore. That value for money is not just about constitutional imperatives. It's that the state has run out of money. You know, to all intents and purposes, we're teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. And if, you know, you're paying 20-30% premiums or, you know, whatever is happening. And, I also noticed that the finance bureaucracies have been very coy about, you know, trying to actually put numbers on this, which I suspect means that they are aware that this is costing a great deal more than it should for a lesser quality of outcomes than South Africa's people would hope for, then that is that's something that simply becomes a matter of survival. Finally, I think that the and this is the sort of second stream is the indexing against the SDGs. Now I know that a lot of people are going to sniff at this and you know, what are the SDGs, or you know, there's the other line of thinking that this is all the blueprint for the one world government, or, you know, whatever else one may be saying. But the SDGs are a kind of standard that has been taken up, at least rhetorically, across Africa. AU documents, for instance, refer to them. And if this is something that the South African government is committed to, then it shouldn't really have a problem with us. Passing large premiums off to a politically connected business person should, you know, in terms of the SDG formulation, come way behind providing the clean water and livable housing and all the rest of it. So yes, very positive. I'm not holding my breath for the implementation, as I say, but, you know, but bit by bit, I think that the sacrosanct nature of these policies is being chipped away, and that is to be welcomed.
Yeah, what I think is really nice about this is that the DA spent quite a lot of time on sort of explaining how the system actually would work. So if you are a person who's kind of doing business with the government, you can now look at this and see what how this hypothetical other world would be. And I think that's powerful for making the arguments about why BEE really isn't the only game in town. And we'll get to the response from the ANC in a second, which once again seems to claim that BEE is the only game in town. So just to be clear, this is a proposed amendment bill on public procurement. And this is the scorecard section of that. So procurement budget in South Africa is very significant. You know, many, many billions of rands are spent on government procuring things, and it's where there's an absolutely enormous amount of corruption, often aided by BEE, which is used as a cover for corrupt contracts. So reforming this system is not just, you know, nice to have, or you know, a positive thing. It's actually key to fixing many of South Africa's deeper problems when it comes to lack of capacity, overspending government budgets, that kind of thing. So the response from the ANC and its allies in COSATU has been pretty much what one would expect. A spokesperson for the ANC said, "All I can stress, though, is that there will not be a day in South Africa where BEE is scrapped as legislation. where there are amendments, I'm certain that, like any piece of legislation, amendments are acceptable for as long as they do not deviate from the substance of that piece of legislation. It is disappointing in 2025 that we are still dealing with a party that wants to take us back to racism, apartheid, and discrimination in our country. COSATU's parliamentary coordinator, Matthew Parks, said that workers, you know, the couple he represents, I presume, would never agree to the proposal. Transformational legislation like broad-based back economic empowerment, employment equity didn't fall from the sky. There were specific response to 3.5 centuries of discrimination when 90% plus of society was denied access to resources and create opportunities to earn a living and so forth. So they are necessary to do what when we have come to the point where they're no longer a necessity, we would have reached an equal society where we don't have legacy and discrimination. You can have that discussion, but for the time being, we need it. And the last thing I just want to note is that the News 24 report on this, I believe, described the DA's policy in the headline as a bold new approach, which even a few years ago, you know, I can't imagine one of the big media houses describing an anti-BE piece of legislation as bold. So that, I think, also is a sign that things are changing. But Terence, you know, just the response from the ANC and COSATU here is exactly what you kind of said, is that there's, you know, sort of no kind of engagement at all with the alternative here. It's just, oh, well, you must just want apartheid back, which is just such a weak argument, particularly when this clearly lays out what the alternative would look like.
Well, there's a few things going on there. One of them is just the dismal standard of public debate, the dumbing down of society, you know, is truly a tragedy to behold. Secondly, I think that a point to be made about the ANC, which I think even today a lot of people would resist making, is that fundamental to its political DNA is that it is a nationalist organization. You know, it's what across the continent you might generically call an African nationalist organization, but I think in the context of a country with South Africa's history and South Africa's demographic makeup, it becomes very much a racial nationalist organization. Now, across the world, these sort of appeals do not generally resonate with poorer people, you know, the excluded, if you like, in whose name they are often proposed. They appeal to those, you know, within that sort of a ruling constituency that are best placed to exploit them. So those with the education, with the political connections, with the access to capital, etc., etc., etc. And I've made this point before. I made this point about the budget, that the ANC's constituency can be put into three broad categories. First of all, let's say it's tenderpreneur class. Those are the people most, you know, aggressively committed to BEE, because it enables the sort of preferential access to state resources. Secondly, it's the civil service. You know, for whom this, you know, a job means, you know, a stable, secure lifestyle at a middle class level. And the third is, you know, what you might call a sort of dependent poor. Your unionized workers would kind of increasingly tend towards that second group, although they are a somewhat different category. Now, those three are all dependent on the state. The COSATU people employed in the pub in the private sector are a somewhat different case. Now, by any, I think, principle of natural justice, or just, you know, sensible reckoning about claim on public resources, the first should be those subsidized poor, the sort of grant beneficiaries, people who are really at the bottom of things, those living in poverty, etc. Secondly, your civil service, whom you need to keep the gears turning, although this being Mzansi, they don't always turn. But, you know, let's say that that's what you paid for, and you know, we can generally get our IDs and our passports. So, and then you know, on top, you know, as a third, those people who, you know, want a special dispensation for themselves to make lots of money. Unfortunately, I think the order of influence is the other way around. It's your politically connected business people, or in quotation marks, business people, you know, some of whom, you know, end up being the subject of things like the Zondo Commission. Secondly, it's your civil service, who, you know, a constituency that is very, that, you know, that will be treated with kid gloves. And as a sort of, I think, distant third, your subsidized poor. And, you know, until there's a shift in that, you know, which is essentially, funnily enough, you know, to speak directly to Kosatu, to look at class over race, you know, we will have these legacy issues for, well, forever. And maybe the DA's proposals aren't a silver bullet, and maybe there are fatal flaws. But to say, well, you know, we got BE and you know, we're going to stick with it, that explains why we are sitting on 1% economic growth and 14% of fixed investment, and why you know, large sections of the country's middle class, you know, starting off with your McDonald's and Smiths, going through to your Van Dieventers, Van Asvierens, to your Naidus and Noordins, and now to your Mkhizis and Mofokengs, are heading for the exit. Is this the future you want? Well, you know, if this is the future you want, this is the present you're going to have. Or maybe I want to turn it around.
If I was to sort of, you know, just kind of raise some things that I think might this, you know, kind of platform might run into problems, this might run into, when you have you know, when you want to look at societal impact, when you want to measure something as complicated as that, you know, you look through the DA's document here, they'll say table 5, and they list verification methods that they would use for various to prove that, you know, that you've done these good things for the community that would get you points towards you know, securing government contracts. And you just see report, NGO affidavit, payroll verification, things like that, which, you know, seems all sort of reasonable. But I think the problem that people might run into here is that, firstly, I wonder how much this is going to reduce compliance, or reduce compliance costs, which are at the moment from BE pretty severe. I presume it will reduce them somewhat, but you can see how, you know, you can produce a lot of paperwork through a system like this, depending exactly on how it's done. And also, you know, it's not going to completely eliminate the ability to defraud what exactly you're doing. Shell companies, fake NGOs, bribe things. And until you have proper investigative capacity and, you know, resources in the state to do that, you're still going to be at risk of corruption. So, yeah, definitely not a silver bullet. I don't know. You know, Terence, that's just my sort of thoughts off the top of my head. What do you make of those concerns?
Look, I think that any system that, you know, wants to influence outcomes will depend on the inputs and the systems in place to enable them. And let's say the DA took over tomorrow morning and could implement this tomorrow afternoon. The problem is you're still dealing with a very shaky state system, particularly at municipal level. So I doubt very much that you are going to that this is going to be error free. What's that phrase the youngsters use? Hate is gonna hate. I think shyster is gonna shyster. You know, that's just something that that you'll learn to work around. And I think that much of, you know, the state has been penetrated by criminal syndicates. And I don't think, I think whether you call it, you know, poverty alleviation or BEE, you know, as much the same, you know, you'll find someone rubbing his hands. Well, I could work with that. But I think the question is, do we get more efficiency? Do we get better outcomes?
That's why the value for money bit is pretty good, right? Is that it focuses on, you know, is this a company that's actually done anything before? Or is it just some shell company as, you know, used to extract resources?
No, absolutely. Maybe in some cases we're just going from absolute catastrophe to mildly disastrous, but that at least is in the right direction.
Yes. And also, you know, why improving those sort of law and order functions in the state is so important to fixing so many of South Africa's other problems. Because, you know, even if you have a pretty good policy, which is what this looks like to me, you know, if you don't have the resources to police bad behavior, you know, you're going to run into problems.
No, absolutely.
Speaking of policing bad behavior, let's move on to our next story. There's a little bit of drama between the South African Police Service and the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police. The Johannesburg Public Safety MMC has accused the police of abusing their power after a couple of Metro police officers were detained in Burkesdal during a vehicle recovery operation. Four officers were arrested on Friday last week alongside two illegal immigrants. After residents mobilized against a raid being conducted by JMPD looking for a stolen vehicle, calling for police intervention. The JMPD officers were preparing to impound a suspected stolen vehicle as part of a raid, according to the MMC. They were arrested on charges by the police of attempted theft, malicious damage to property, trespassing, defeating the ends of justice, and the two illegal immigrants are facing a charge of contravening the Immigration Act. The MMC for Public Safety, Shawaku in Joburg, says that this was a legitimate operation responding to credible intelligence regarding a stolen vehicle. And he said, while the JMPD officers were securing evidence and preparing to impound the vehicle, SAPS officers from Burkesdal Police Station arrived unannounced and proceeded to arrest our team on baseless and fabricated charges. This is a blatant abuse of power, and SAPS confiscated our officers' firearms, mobile phones, and official vehicles, detaining them over the entire weekend without due process. This incident highlights a disturbing pattern of interference and hostility that undermines the collaborative law enforcement efforts in Gauteng and jeopardizes public safety. He added, it is deeply puzzling and frankly suspicious why SAPS Burkesdal elected to arrest the JMPD recovery team mid-operation instead of assisting with processing the scene and seizing assets from high-level organized crime. The police commissioner in Gauteng, Lieutenant General Tommy Ntobeni, said that he believed that SAPS officers had acted lawfully in arresting the JMPD members. Mm. So it seems like cops fighting cops is all in the news these days with the Matlanga Commission. Terence, as you pointed out in our pre-show discussions, it's not the first time JMPD and SAPS have come to blows. And you know what? Frankly, I don't really trust either of them. So I'm not sure really who to believe. My suspicion here, though, is that this was very weird by SAPS.
There's once again, there's a couple of moving parts of the story. Yes, first of all, this isn't the first time there's been issues between the two. I think it's about 15 years ago. There was an incident on the highway. I think that runs sort of on the south of just below the city center. Where they literally had a gun battle while motorists sort of cowered under their cars, and no one, as far as I could establish, and I actually had a question asked in the Gauteng legislature about this some years later, was disciplined or prosecuted for it. So yes, you know, just remember you discharge a firearm, that bullet has to go somewhere, and let's just say that the optics are particularly bad when, you know, it's a sort of cop versus cop affair. The second thing to note is that the ANC furiously resisted police devolution. Their idea was one police force for the whole country, or police service, depending on who the minister is at the time. We're police service right now, I understand. That's fine. Well, it's not actually, because that sort of centralized policing doesn't is not optimal. But as long as we have it, and your municipal police service force, metro or whatever, are meant to police, you know, it was meant to provide a kind of auxiliary role and police things like traffic. Well, then, you know, they should know to stay in their lane. And something like this, it would seem to me, you would need to actually coordinate with the police. But you're quite correct. I think there is a massive deficit of public trust. And that's because people, A, do not feel protected, and B, there's plenty of experience of, let's say, police officers at all levels of less than stellar probity. So yeah, you know, when something like this happens, you know, you have to wonder why the one is arresting the arresters. And even if it's entirely above board, the context that's been created is such that that sort of suspicion is inevitable, which is not great. You know, there's one thing that really threatens a society, and that's an attack on its law enforcement agencies. But there's a corollary to that mistrust of law enforcement agencies is also a huge destabilizer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this presumably should be solved by having some outside credible force investigate what's going on here. And that just doesn't exist right now, unfortunately. I'm not quite sure how we're going to exactly solve this sort of thing. But as you say, you know, not great for law and order.
Not great at all.
Okay, last point for today we're going to be talking about is there's been a lot of concern that government is filled with ghost workers. I know it's Halloween soon, but these are not, in fact, spooky people, you know, walking the hallways of government buildings at night. They are people who don't actually exist, but whom someone is collecting the salary for, who supposedly hold jobs in government. Now, remember, I think it was Prasa supposedly has this huge chunk of the ghost employees that was discovered a couple of years ago. And there have now been questions for a while over how widespread a problem this is across government. I believe one of the things the DA demanded during the budget negotiations with the ANC was to conduct an audit of ghost employees. Well, it looks like there's now sort of a date set on that. The Department of Public Service and Administration has given government departments until February 28th to submit a comprehensive report on how many ghost employees they have found. They're embarking on a number of ways to do this. One is a drive to physically verify over 1 million national and provincial public service employees. They're also going to be checking ID numbers, attendance records, payroll verification, and the like. And foreign workers will need to have their permits verified. Terence, it seems a little bit like this should have been done a very long time ago, and that if you had competent management, it would be a routine thing. Like, someone should notice if someone who's on the payroll isn't showing up for work. Nevertheless, this seems like a positive thing.
Yeah, in principle, 10 out of 10 to the department for this. But, you know, as long as we're talking about the esoteric and unexplained in the form of spectral workers, let me raise another such concept, and that is déjà vu, the feeling that you've been here before. And if you feel that way, well, you should, because as long ago as the 1990s, this was a problem. And I remember correctly, in about 1998, the Limpopo government made its workers literally stand outside their offices with their ID books in hand, so somebody could go with a clipboard and tick them off. And let's just say they found that a lot of people, you know, who had numbers on their payroll were not standing outside those offices with their ID books. You see, I think actually you may be being a bit harsh. A manager may not know that somebody is on the payroll, you know, because that is probably simply a book entry in a computer somewhere. But there are all sorts of odd things that can happen, you know, with payments being redirected, and, you know, the same, and seven workers who've never been seen in their offices, you know, all their salaries going to one bank account. Yes, in principle, this is a problem that has to be addressed, and it's not an insurmountable problem. And I'm actually quite pleased that they're going back to the let's call it the wet thumb method, where you know someone is going to go and check you, like, are you this person? Show me your ID. Show me your work permit. Rather than, you know, having some insane AI algorithm crawling through and, you know, discovering that every seventh person, you know, whose name starts with an M is clearly, you know, fabricated. Don't trust AI on these things. We need a human hand at the tiller. So yes, 100%. But it's not enough just to weed these out. People who are profiting from this, they need to be prosecuted. And I suspect that some of this is being done by syndicates. This isn't just one chancer who managed to kind of inveigle his late brother's ID into the system, for a bit of pocket money. I imagine that there are probably areas where this is on, to all intents and purposes, an industrial scale. If I'm wrong, I will be impressed. But I think, you know, given the record of the South African state, I'm probably not wrong.
Yeah, you know, one really has to wonder what percentage of the public workforce on the books is just, you know, doesn't actually exist. You know, is it 1%? Is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is there something even higher than that? We don't know. I think it's also important that I very strongly suspect that there are going to be departments and managers and things who miss the deadline on the 28th. And if, you know, someone does miss the deadline, they must be punished because it immediately raises questions about, you know, why can't you do something as core and fundamental as this?
If you want a more recent example than Limpopo circa 1998, try the abuse of COVID grants. How many of those were going to public servants of less than public spirited inclination? This is great. Look, there's one thing that we have some public servants who are not up to their tasks. That's a problem. When the public servant is not there at all and doesn't exist, that's from an altogether different magnitude.
I must say, today's topics were a little bit better news than we often get to talk about on the show. We had the country's second biggest political party, clearly defining its opposition to what have been very bad policies that have come out of government. So that's very good. And, you know, government is also moving forward on working out how many spooky ghosts there are amongst their ranks, which I think is also really important.
If I make a suggestion to the department, they could make this a really fun affair if they gave their inspectors a sort of beige overall and they pumped that 80s hit Ghostbusters through the corridors as they did it.
I was thinking more Tubular Bells from The Exorcist, but no, that works well too.
Yeah, anyway. No, look, I think that's taking pessimism a bit far. No, I'd rather see Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and.
No, point well taken. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.